Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a case that's really a landmark when you're looking at how class action lawsuits work, especially in those, you know, complicated situations where a product might have harmed a whole bunch of people. In Retailtronics pacing systems. Think of this as like your essential guide to understanding how courts figure out when it makes sense for people hurt by the same thing to, well, band together legally. It's about weighing efficiency against everyone's right to individual justice.
Exactly. And the product here, Telectronics pacemakers, made between 88 and 94, specifically the ones with these AccuFix atrial J leads.
Right, the J leads. And the critical issue was that tiny wire inside, through a tension wire.
That's the one. It was designed to keep the lead in place, but had this tendency in some patients to fracture.
And a fracture wasn't minor. We're talking potentially serious injuries and, sadly, even deaths in some cases.
Yeah.
So the fundamental legal question that bubbles up is, in a product liability situation like this one, when can you actually form a class action? And that brings us to Rule 23.
Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. That's the rule book, essentially, for class actions in federal court. It lays out all the requirements.
Okay, so before we get deep into Rule 23, let's set the scene. What was the timeline here?
Well, reports of these pacemaker problems started surfacing, and pretty quickly, over 400 individual lawsuits were filed.
Wow, 400?
Yeah, a lot. So to handle that efficiently, they were consolidated into what's called multi-district litigation, an MDL down in Ohio.
An MDL, right. That's where you bring similar federal cases together before one judge for pretrial stuff like discovery. It streamlines things.
Exactly. Streamlining is the goal. It prevents duplication and conflicting rulings early on.
And what were the plaintiffs, the people filing these suits, actually alleging?
Their claims were pretty serious. They argued, one, defective design, that the pacemakers were flawed from the start. Two, failure to warn doctors and patients about the fracture risk.
Yeah.
And three, just general negligence that Telectronics didn't act reasonably careful in how they handled the whole situation.
Now, didn't Telectronics set up some kind of institute?
They did, yeah. The AccuFix Research Institute. On paper, it was meant to monitor the risks associated with the leads and communicate with doctors. Seems responsible, right?
Uh-huh. Sounds like it.
But the plaintiffs argued it was too little, too late. Their argument was that Telectronics already knew about the J-lead defect before setting up the institute and hadn't done enough to prevent harm.
So the institute was seen more as a reaction than a proactive safety measure, at least by the plaintiffs.
That was their contention, yes. And it's crucial, as you said, to remember that this wire fracturing wasn't just some legal theory. It was a real physical danger for people with these devices.
Absolutely. Imagine relying on that device and then finding out it could break inside you.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
So the case moves forward. Procedurally, what happens next?
Okay, so the first class action suits get filed around 95, 97. And importantly, the court did certify a global class action initially.
For which claims?
It covered negligence, strict liability, that's liability, without needing to prove fault, just that the product was defective and caused harm, and also medical monitoring. We'll circle back to that one.
Got it.
Negligence, strict liability, medical monitoring. Certified.
Then in 1998, something pretty interesting happens. A non-binding summary jury trial.
Ah, summary jury trial, like a mock trial, basically.
Exactly. It's a way to gauge potential jury reactions. And in this case, the summary jury found Telectronics negligent per se.
Negligent per se, because they violated a law.
Precisely. The finding was based on violating specific FDA regulations. It's like, you broke this safety rule, therefore you were negligent. It simplifies proving that element.
Okay, that's a significant finding, even if non-binding. How did that impact things?
Well, it likely put pressure on Telectronics. Following that, two settlements were reached, one in 98, another in 2001.
And those settlements created?
A pretty substantial $58 million patient benefit fund for compensation, plus a medical monitoring program to keep track of patients with those leads. Right, the medical monitoring program.
Look, here's the crucial bit we flagged earlier. Putative damages were excluded from that class certification.
Ah, yes. Punitive damages, the ones meant to punish and deter, not just compensate. Why exclude those, especially after the negligence per se finding? That seems counterintuitive.
Exactly. It's the core tension. So that leads us right into the main legal questions the court had to grapple with.
Okay, let's break them down.
First, the basic class certification question under Rule 23b3. Did the common issues, like was the design defective? Did Telectronics know? Did those predominate over the individual issues, like the specific type and severity of each person's injury?
The predominance requirement. Always a big hurdle in mass torts.
Second, medical monitoring. Could the court actually mandate one single monitoring program for everyone? Or were individual health needs just too varied? This relates more to Rule 23b1 or b2 certification, often focusing on injunctive or declaratory relief.
Right, the type of relief sought influences the subsection of Rule 23 you look at.
And third, the million-dollar question, or maybe the multi-million-dollar question. Punitive damages. Why deny class certification for those, given everything else?
Okay, so how did Judge Spiegel rule on these?
All right, Judge Spiegel certified three subclasses. First, medical monitoring. He certified that under Rule 23B1.
B1A. That's the one used to avoid inconsistent rulings, right?
Exactly. The risk was that different courts might order different conflicting monitoring programs. Certifying under B1A allowed for one uniform approach, preventing that chaos.
Makes sense. What about negligence and strict liability?
Those were certified too, but under Rule 23B3. Here, the court did find that common issues predominated. Specifically, the question of whether the pacemaker design itself was defective was seen as the central, common question suitable for class treatment.
So liability could be determined on a class-wide basis for those claims.
Yes, but then we get to punitive damages. And here the court hit the brakes.
Why? What was the reasoning?
State law variations. The court pointed out, look, punitive damage laws are all over the map. Different states have different caps, different standards of proof. Some ban them entirely for certain claims.
Ah, the choice of law problem in nationwide class actions. It's a classic issue.
It really is. The court basically concluded that trying to manage 50 different state standards for punitive damages within one single class action, it would be completely unmanageable. It just wouldn't be a superior method for handling that specific issue, which is another requirement under Rule 23b3.
So superiority and manageability were the key barriers for punitives.
Precisely. And the court stressed it was sticking to the text of Rule 23, not making a policy judgment. They were applying the rules as written.
Okay. Now, you mentioned the court said something about this case being an exception regarding individualized proof in medical cases.
Yes. That's a really interesting point. The court stated, the J. Lead controversy is the exception to the rule that medical liability cases need individualized proof. Why?
Why indeed? Usually medical causation is very individual.
Well, the court reasoned that unlike, say, a drug causing a disease that develops slowly and could have multiple causes, the injury here was more direct. The wire fractures, that's a specific event.
Yeah.
It causes immediate physical harm.
Ah, so the causal link was clearer and more uniform across the class. Less need for individual investigation into how the injury occurred?
Exactly. That directness simplified the causation element enough, in the court's view, to make a class-wide finding on liability feasible, unlike in many other medical product cases involving latent diseases or complex etiologies.
That's a crucial distinction. It highlights how the specific nature of the defect and injury impacts the suitability for class treatment.
So, stepping back, what's the big takeaway from Telectronics? Why is it so significant?
Well, for anyone studying MDLs or mass torts, it's a prime example of that balancing act courts perform. Balancing efficiency, handling hundreds of claims at once, with fairness to individuals. The court used class certification strategically. Certify the common stuff like defect and the need for monitoring, but draw the line where individual issues and state law variations become overwhelming, like with punitive damages.
So two big lessons, maybe.
I think so. First, the flexibility of Rule 23, especially using subclasses, it's a tool courts can use to manage these massive complex cases by breaking them down.
Okay, flexibility.
Second, the persistent challenge of state law variations. Telectronics really highlights how differences, especially in areas like punitive damages, can block nationwide class certification on certain issues, even when the underlying conduct is the same.
And the court kind of grounds itself, saying, look, we just apply the rules Congress gives us.
Exactly. They have to work within that Rule 23 framework.
So for our listeners, the practical insight here is seeing how these huge product defect battles are structured legally. You see, the factors courts weigh commonality, predominance, superiority, manageability, and how tricky it gets with 50 different state legal systems involved.
Absolutely. It's about finding the right tool for the job. Sometimes a full class action fits, sometimes subclasses fit, and sometimes, for certain issues, individual lawsuits remain the only viable path, especially for damages that are highly variable or governed by disparate state laws.
We've covered a lot. the defective pacemakers, the procedural journey, the class certification decisions, certifying some claims, denying others like punitives, and the case's overall significance.
Right, and it leaves us with a really interesting thought, doesn't it? The court here emphasized the direct physical harm from the wire fracture.
Mm-hmm.
So how might courts handle class certification when the harm from a product is less immediate, more diffuse, maybe harder to link directly? Think about environmental exposures or drugs with long latency side effects. Does Telectronics reasoning apply, or does the lack of that direct, immediate harm make class certification much harder? It keeps that tension between efficiency and individual justice front and center.